Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. When it comes to politics, there's always an election around the corner. Many are waiting on a key decision to be made. Will Governor J.B. Pritzker run for another term? The election is next year, but the governor will need to announce his intentions this summer. He's also rumored to be eyeing a bid for the White House, and he's not the only Illinois Democrat with that ambition. We'll talk about it ahead. We visit with a Central Illinois Congressman, Republican Darren LaHood, and get his thoughts on the GOP and what is happening in Washington. We remember the late actor George Wendt, a Chicago native. Two of his friends and colleagues stopped by. And high-speed rail could link several Illinois cities, some that have no rail service now. Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Will Governor J.B. Pritzker run for a third term? Well, there is no doubt he is considering a White House bid in 2028, but he needs to decide first if he wants to remain the state's chief executive. It's likely he'll make an announcement in coming weeks. But Pritzker isn't the only one who could be eyeing the presidency. Some think former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel is interested. Dave McKinney's a political reporter with WBEZ. He talked about it all with Sasha Ann Simons.
So that next Illinois gubernatorial election, that's next year, 2026. Realistically, Dave, how long does Pritzker really have to figure this out once and for all?
Well, to figure out his gubernatorial reelection plans, he really has until August to figure that out, because that's when nominating petitions for the 2026 primary start being circulated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the last time he made a reelection announcement, it was I think it was in July, early July, late June. And I think, you know, it's realistic to sort of see that June-July period for him to make some public announcement.
Make some announcement about whether which direction he's going in, right? Because I think we figure he's going in one of the two.
Well, with reelection, I think the smart money in Springfield has him seeking reelection. I mean, he has not done anything to dissuade anyone from believing that.
Yeah.
And several people, the Illinois House Speaker, Emanuel Chris Welch, for example, I spoke with him, and he said he believes, just based on Pritzker's body language, that he's going to run again. So
yeah.
I think there's a prevailing view in Springfield he will run.
So if he does go for the presidency, which has been long rumored, I mean, what would that mean for Illinois' government and for Democrats in the state? Because they would be losing Durbin and another leader like Pritzker.
Yeah, I mean, it would set up a pretty unusual situation what it would mean for Illinois, I guess, potentially, is that you would have a governor, if he was running for president, he would have a fair amount of distraction. I mean, you can't
yeah.
run for president, being under attack by rivals, by perhaps President Trump and Truth Social, what
mm-hmm.
have you. It would be easy to take your eye off the ball in Springfield. I mean, Pritzker has an experienced staff working for him. He's got friendly Democrats in both chambers of the legislature helping him out. I mean, it can kind of run on automatic pilot to some extent there,
yeah.
but I think it would be a challenge for
yeah.
sure.
It's interesting that you mentioned Trump being one of the possible distractions, considering that he can't run again.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, he has made noises that he's looking into it. Other times saying, no, the Constitution is pretty clear that he can't run.
Right. You talked about this with David Axelrod, former chief strategist and senior advisor to President Barack Obama. What did he say about the topic?
Well, Axelrod is one of the most seasoned political consultants in the land. I mean, he was a key guy in helping Obama win the White House two times. And when I talked to Axelrod, he thought that Pritzker would be a formidable presidential candidate, and he thought he had put up a good record as governor in Springfield. But he had a word of warning for the governor, and that was, if you are genuine about running for president, then it might not be smart to seek re-election as governor, because you really need to, as we said earlier,
mm-hmm.
keep your eye on the ball
right.
When you're running for president. It's all important. Axelrod called it a hellacious job running for president, and he should know.
Well, here is Pritzker's response to that.
David's a friend of mine. Here's what I can say. I think he has in mind the idea that his friend Rahm Emanuel would like to run for governor of Illinois. Probably wouldn't run for governor if I were running for re-election. So that's one thing that I think he's considering.
And so it's clear, Dave, could Pritzker seek a third term and run for presidency later? Could he do both? It sounds like he's being advised not to, but he could, right?
Well, yeah, legally, there's no prohibition. I mean, unlike the federal government, there is no term limit in Illinois. And the record for being governor in Illinois is held by Jim Thompson, the former the late Republican governor who served four terms and 14 years. Pritzker, if he serves out a full three terms, would be at 12 years. So he'd still be short of the record. But he could do both legally. But it's just more of a question of, you know, is it the smart thing to do? And I think that's what Axelrod said. Yeah. Now, in that clip you played, what's interesting, you know, to hear the governor inject Rahm Emanuel into the mix, because I think that caught some people by surprise, because, you know, the interview I had with Axelrod, I mean, not once did he mention Rahm Emanuel's name or promoting him. So that I think it caused people's ears to perk.
Like, what are you hearing that, you know, that we don't know, perhaps? Speaking of Rahm Emanuel, he was on TV. He was on ABC's daytime talk show, The View. Let's hear a little bit of what he had to say.
You don't sound like a presidential candidate.
No, I am in training. I don't know if I'll make the Olympics, though.
If you couldn't hear the beginning there, one of the hosts said, you sound like a presidential candidate. Where does Emanuel fit into all of this?
Well, I mean, he went in front of the Economic Club of Chicago back in March. And at that point, he told people he didn't think that his life in public service was over. I mean, his most recent stint was under the Biden administration, and he was ambassador to Japan. And so when Trump came in, that ended. And Rahm is looking for a job in public life, it sounds like. And there on the program you mentioned, The View, he spent a long time just kind of bashing Donald Trump. And you know, the lead into that statement you just played, I mean, he was talking about how he thought that the American dream, the idea that hard work is going to lead to prosperity for people and everybody can attain that, that's out of reach for people.
Absolutely.
And so that's kind of what triggered those hosts to say, you sound like a presidential candidate.
Yeah, he looked the part, if I may say so. I was watching, and just the posture throughout the interview, the things he was saying. He was, again, as you mentioned, very much talking about what Trump's doing, even Democrats calling them weak and woke. I was looking at your piece that you wote about this, and you actually said Rahm Emanuel flirted with the idea that he would run for president. I'm thinking, I don't know, Dave, that felt pretty close to a confirmation.
Yeah, it was beyond the first date.
Beyond the first date, for sure. So could we see this future where both Pritzker and Emanuel are competing for president?
Well, it's conceivable. I mean, they could be on a collision course. I mean, two of Illinois' best-known politicians coming at this from different vantage points. Rahm Emanuel, of course, you know, he was a congressman. He served in the Clinton White House. He was an advisor to Obama. He's got shrewd political skills. And you know, the way he turns phrases and frames arguments, I think, you know, he's a very good communicator.
Yeah.
Pritzker, I think, you know, he's amassed, you know, in the minds of many Democrats, he's amassed a really brilliant record in Springfield. He's hit a lot of issues that the Democratic voting base just absolutely adores in Springfield. And you know, he's pretty much operated, not pretty much, he's operated a scandal-free, corruption-free administration there in a state that, as you know, is famed
full of it.
Yeah, famed for its corruption.
I'll leave it there. Yeah, I'm also trying to picture what this would look like on the ground, the two of them campaigning for this big job.
Well, you could have a very big field. I mean, it is an open seat. And, you know, assuming that Trump doesn't devise some way to claim to try to be able to run again, which, again, the Constitution doesn't allow that.
Right.
But you know, assuming that our norms are in place at that point in time, you know, you could see a situation of J.D. Vance or Marco Rubio on the Republican side duking it out. And then on the Democratic side, there are
these two and a bunch of others.
Many, many others.
Have we seen this before? Two high profile candidates from Illinois running for president?
Well, I mean, the time I remember, and this goes way back early in my reporting career, 1988, it was a presidential campaign. And on the Democratic side, we had the late U.S. Senator Paul Simon, and then the civil rights leader, the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Both of them were in the Democratic primary for president. Neither one made the cut that year, But it has happened, and I don't think that the two of them had, you know, it didn't turn acrimonious between the two of them, I don't believe. But there is precedent for it. But, you know, in this case, you know, you have two kind of larger-than-life political figures in Illinois that both know how to they both have the resources or access to the resources to run credible campaigns. And so, you know, it could be a you know, for political junkies like you and me, it could be a very fun thing to watch.
Lots of commercials.
Yeah.
I can see them now.
The TV station owners will be quite happy.
They will. They certainly will. Any Democrat that's running for president in 2028 will be running against President Trump's record. Right, Dave? The Pritzker, I think, has certainly emerged as a very anti-Trump voice nationally. What about Rahm Emanuel? How does he measure up when it comes to that?
Well, I mean, you've seen him really over the last couple of months. He's been making the rounds, I would say, just as actively, maybe even a little more aggressively.
So more than just Pritzker the things has. He was saying on The View.
Yeah, for sure. And again, the way he's kind of framed these arguments, like, you know, one of the kind of culture war issues that Republicans have, you know, they ran it in the presidential election. They continue to focus on it, transgender rights. You know, what you hear Rahm Emanuel say, or I've heard him say in a couple of these appearances, is, you know, the real focus should be on the fact that public schools are failing. They're failing to get, you know, reading scores up and math scores up and things like that.
Yeah, he said we're focused on the wrong things.
That's where the focus should be, instead of on, you know, what goes on in the restrooms in school buildings. And so that's the way he frames the arguments. And it's, you know, to somebody who's kind of, I've listened to messaging in these political campaigns for a long time.
Sure.
And that's just a creative way of twisting the argument in a different way.
Mm-hmm. He says he was in training in that clip earlier. What do you think that looks like behind the scenes?
I don't know that he needs to be trained too heavily because he's been around a lot of these big campaigns in his life.
Right.
So I think he does know how to do. But, you know, he's like all of these aspiring presidential candidates. They kind of want to size up the field. They want to get a sense from donors about, you know, can we get money? Of course, Pritzker doesn't have that problem.
Right.
He could self-fund the campaign as
it.
A billionaire. But and Rahm Emanuel is known as a prolific fundraiser himself. So I think these two candidates would have access to resources to really be able to run campaigns if they chose to.
Run campaigns, and in your view, would either have a chance, Dave?
Well, I think they would have a chance, you know, but again, you're it's a bit sight unseen because you don't know what the full field looks like. And again, there's a lot of time between now and, you know, when a presidential campaign would really start kicking into high gear to know.
We'll leave it there. Dave McKinney is a WBEZ state politics reporter. Thanks so much.
Sasha, thanks for having me.
Imagine hopping on a train in central Illinois and being in downtown Chicago in less than an hour. The Illinois Department of Transportation wants to know if that's something travelers in Illinois want. A study has been commissioned to explore the feasibility of adding trains that can reach speeds of 200 miles per hour to travel from Chicago to St. Louis. The lines could also have links to Peoria, Decatur, Moline, and Rockford. Raymond Lai is executive director of the McLean County Regional Planning Commission. He serves on the High Speed Railway Commission. He talked about the survey with student reporter Ben Howell.
But I think for statewide, you know, from economic development perspective, and also for residents, visitors, you know, they can move from one point to another point, you know, say from Chicago to St. Louis, much shorter time than currently would take. And people have to, you know, can work at a, you know, different city that they can come home. Say they can live, say in Bloomington Normal. They work in Chicago. I mean, they can do their daily commute through high speed train, for example. And also having the high speed, it's just to giving people more choices and also good use of time. And then you save time that you can do more things.
For the survey specifically, how will the results affect the plan for the train? And what I was kind of getting at was, what happens if McLean County has either like an outstanding opposition or encouragement of it? How will that really affect the plan?
I think that would give the consultant and the High Speed Rail Commission a good assessment of, is really that much interest in the state? It's because it's going to impact the state as a whole, but then also Depending on the routes and the stops, it would, you know, affect, you know, the different cities and towns along the way. And so I think it is would be good to say, hey, it's more or just support, you know, for high-speed rail, because it's going to cost a lot of money, a lot of work. It will take years before it happens, even if there's a strong needs in that identify. But it's at least to gauge, hey, if it's something that a lot of people don't even want to see it. And so that would give the commission and then the decision makers, you know, how fast should we go? So it goes, could cost lots of time and money, even to for this feasibility study for this high-speed rail.
That was getting at one of my questions as well, is that what are the chances of the rail actually happening? And if it does, are we talking years? Are we talking decades? What does that planning look mm-hmm. like?
It takes time. But if we don't start, it's probably go nowhere. And then in terms of money, it takes all kinds. It could be a public-private partnership. And so it doesn't have to be all government money. And so, yeah, we would first look at what's the feasibility and viability of such a high-speed rail for the state. And then definitely, you know, the financial part will be considered and looked at, but there are different options. So such as the one in Florida, I mean, there's some public-private partnership, actually more private interest. And so there are different ways of financing such. If the market, if the ridership are there, and so it will be attractive enough for somebody to invest, to put that investment in.
That's Raymond Lai from the McLean County Regional Planning Commission. He spoke with reporter Ben Howell. We remember a beloved actor from Chicago. That's ahead next on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The actor George Wendt died recently. He was 76. He died in Los Angeles, but he was Chicago all the way. Wendt was born in the Beverly neighborhood, and he got his start at Second City in the 1970s. Sasha Ann Simons checked in with two of Wendt's longtime friends and collaborators. Wendt's career spanned more than 50 years, but he's best remembered for his role as the barfly Norm on the classic TV show Cheers.
Good morning, everybody.
Hey, Mr. Peterson, what's up?
The warranty on my liver.
Still pouring, Norm?
That's funny. I was about to ask you the same thing.
Hey, some storm, huh?
Yeah. I don't get home to Vera soon, that road's gonna be closed. I'd say about another half hour or so ought to do it.
That role earned Wendt 6 Primetime Emmy nominations for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series. Joining us now for more on the man behind the character is one of George Wendt's longtime friends. BJ Jones is an artistic director at Northlight Theater. BJ, thank you so much for joining us.
Sasha, thanks for having me on.
Sorry for your loss. I know this is very fresh news. How are you doing?
Well, I'm good. I mean, it's shocking, of course. And it's he's all of our friends when you think about it. Norm was a character he created, but it came from the spirit of who George Wendt is, and mm-hmm. that came across on film. I just loved hearing those clips that you were playing.
Yes.
They were so incredibly funny and so incredibly George.
Yeah.
I can't think of anybody else who could have played the role in the way that he did.
Absolutely.
And he was gracious about it. You know, he also went to some of these Comic Cons, and he always had people asking for pictures and autographs, and he referred to them as the Norm petting zoo. And in person he was hilarious, but also one of the most generous and empathetic actors I know.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing, Sasha, is that yes, he's known for Norm. And yes, he's known for being here in town anyway, as being a star of Second City. But what a lot of people didn't realize was that he was an extraordinary actor mm-hmm. with depth and genuine skill. And, you know, I was lucky enough to do four shows with him here at Northlight. Two of them were world premieres. And, you know, his work spanned from television, which he was truly an iconic figure.
Absolutely.
In the history of television.
Yeah.
And which is saying something. To hear at Northlight on stage in legitimate dramatic roles. He played Willie Loman in Toronto in Death of a Salesman. And then he worked on Broadway and London and Ireland.
Wow.
He was probably the most underrated actor that I've ever had the pleasure to work with.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about some of these things that you mentioned. First, I got to say, it's wonderful to hear not just about Norm, but what George went meant to you, BJ. And, you know, you talk about what the chatter has been over the last day or so. A lot of people are also talking about his great comedic timing, BJ, you know, and his humanity as well. Just how great of a guy he was, as you just laid out to us, which I think is extremely heartening, and it's kind of rare. You don't always hear that about successful Hollywood actors, do you?
No, you don't. And, you know, but again, I go back to George knew more about the legitimate theater than almost anyone I know. He kept up with what was going on, not just nationally, but he also kept an eye on the London stage as well. And in terms of timing, he was absolutely impeccable and deft. Mm-hmm. You know, he never pushed a joke. In fact, he got more laughs out of doing absolutely nothing at just the right time than almost any actor I know. And part of it was, of course, his persona. You know, George showed up and you started laughing because of who he was. And this was even before, you know, I've known him since when he was on stage at Second City.
Right.
With an extraordinary cast like Danny Breen and Tim Kazurinsky. Mm-hmm. And
Tim Kazurinsky has just called us. He's an actor and former writer for Saturday Night Live. Tim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Sasha. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you so much for taking the time to join the conversation. I want to dive right in and hear stories from you, Tim, from your relationship with George that you think really illustrate what kind of guy he was when the lights were off and when the cameras were off.
Yeah, well, George was just such the real deal. I was just listening to you guys and talking about George's deadpan, knowing when to do nothing. His timing, comic timing, was insanely good. That mirrors, I mean, Jack Benny knew how to hold, and George always knew how to hold. He never mugged. He always thought that less is more. I remember as a kid that Droopy was one of my favorite cartoon characters, and George was so adroit at doing that, kind of getting laughs out of doing nothing. I remembered we did a memorable cowboy scene that Fred Kaz wrote a song for us, in which we were three cowboys, George, myself, and Bruce Jarko, and we pretty much did nothing. There were long silences, and this scene just, it killed. People would just go nuts for it.
Yeah, I bet.
It was what we kind of didn't do because it was so lonesome on the range. It was perhaps my favorite scene to do ever. George was just remarkable.
Yeah. If his top character that he was known for was Norm from Cheers, as we've mentioned, I think a close second could be his character in the famous recurring SNL skit, Bill Swirsky's Superfans. Let's listen.
We are coming to you live from Ditka's here on Thanksgiving Day, a day for giving thanks for or taking punishment from a team that is known as the Bears.
The Bears.
With me, as always, are the super fans. Gentlemen, how was your week?
Real good.
Fantastic.
Real good.
Fantastic.
Good. Any heart attacks?
I had one.
Had a couple.
Good. All right.
Tim, you met George in the 70s when you were at Second City, the two of you. What do you remember most about those days?
51 years I've known George. Half a century of on stage, backstage, and pubs, and over the phone. He was the same guy all that time. He didn't change. Success to fame did not change him at all. He was still that kid from Beverly at Christ the King Parish. And I have to say, in 50 years, I never heard him say a mean thing about anybody.
Wow.
It's highly unusual. I remember around the year 2000, I was doing a film for Granada, a movie that was going to be shooting in Liverpool, based on a true story. And the producer of the movie, George was doing a show called Art. And I said, I got to go see my friend George. And halfway through, George was brilliant in it, of course, had a spectacular monologue that was very un-Swirsky. the producer leaned over and says, what about George as the best friend in the script? I said, I would die to have George do that. And he said, how are we going to get him? I said, well, we'll have a beer after the show. You can ask him. So we had a beer afterwards and asked George, and he said that he would be honored.
He's
and
on board.
He was amazing in the movie. Julie Walters won the British Academy, the BAFTA, for her performance. But George was just fantastic as the best friend of Paul Reiser.
Let's hear from George himself here. This is where he's talking about his start at Second City. He was on a podcast. Everybody knows your name.
And this is the workshop teacher,
right?
Josephine Forsberg. I think you might be ready for the children's theater. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Because they worked right on the main stage at Second City. So I thought that'd be just where all these people were, Joe Flaherty and Brian Murray and Harold Ramis. And so, come in Sunday, come in at 11 o'clock. And I go, oh, I thought the show was at 2:30. Yeah, just come in at 11. I ring the doorbell and nobody. Finally, I get let in and she hands me the broom and the dustpan. What happens is she wanted me to sweep up the room, and the night porter didn't come in till like a couple hours before the show. Cocktail glasses everywhere, cigarette butts on the floors, and in drinks and in ashtrays, like I had to clean up the room.
BJ, you produced a 2012 production of Neil Simon's The Odd Couple, which starred Tim and George. What was that like?
It's funny you say it. I'm laughing because George actually never played the play here. I hope I can tell this story. And Tim, you can correct me as I go. But
give me the short version.
The short version is that after tech one night, Tim and George went to the Celtic Knot in Evanston for a beer, and George didn't feel good, and Tim took him to the emergency ward, and he was having a heart attack.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so I quick ran to the hospital. Timmy called me, and I ran to the hospital. And the next day, I came to the hospital, and I was with Bernadette, his wife, and I went up to the room, and the surgeon came in and said, well, we're going to have to put a stent in your heart. And he said, well, I can't do that. We open on Friday. This guy's my boss. He points to me. This guy's my boss. Tell him, Beej, I got to do the show on Friday. And I said, George, we have an understudy. I am not going to make Bernadette a widow by you doing the show on Friday. And so he never got to do the show. The understudy went on and, did a great job.
Well, I got to leave it there. I mean, certainly some great memories of George that'll keep us all laughing for years to come. Let's go out on George himself, giving him the last word as Norm on Cheers. We've been talking with BJ Jones, who's an artistic director at Northlight Theater, and Tim Kazurinsky, who's an actor and former writer for SNL. Here's George.
Some people spend their whole lives in a bar. Just yesterday, some guy sat right here next to me for 11 hours.
Sometimes
things you want to go, where everybody knows your name, and they're always glad you came. You want to be where you can see, our troubles are all the same. You want to be where everybody knows your name.
This is Statewide. Since January, the Trump administration has rolled out a slew of anti-LGBTQ orders and directives. This includes potential barriers to gender-affirming health care and reversing protections for LGBTQ plus students in schools. Reporter Aoishi Basu talked with an Illinois drag performer who says they inspire hope during difficult times.
Seduction Carrington has been doing drag in Central Illinois for almost 30 years. She says she loves performing. A video on her social media feed shows Seduction wearing a cape, dancing, and lip-syncing. At one point, she swings the cape around her body, kicks it up, and the crowd goes wild.
I always tell people drag is a summation of all my life's failures. Everything that I wanted to be, drag lets me be. Being born in the 70s, schooling in the 80s and 90s in Decatur, Illinois, some of the things that I wanted to be, that area never really presented those opportunities. Because in those days, career day in grade school and junior high, you were your typical careers, your doctors, your lawyers, your firefighters. They didn't say being an artist. They didn't say being a choreographer.
The Carrington family is one of the most prominent drag families in Central Illinois. Seduction says a drag family is just like any other family.
Because, you know, family is not necessarily defined by blood, but you have your moms and your dads and your aunts and your uncles and your cousins and your nieces and your nephews. And I have a drag granddaughter who is 12, and I have a drag daughter of my own who is 12. And, you know, when you have drag family members that young, you have to be really careful how you introduce them to society. So, because, you know, someone always is going to make it something that it's not. You know, oh, you sicko, you pervert, you da 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 da. We have heterosexual people who identify as heterosexual in the family. Like, my family is diverse. I welcome everybody. We have all races, body types. If you love being on the stage, then, you know, come on, let's rock it.
In this current political climate, Seduction says she's noticed drag and activism coinciding more. She tells me about her drag daughter, Calexis, who lives in St. Louis and directs shows at Rehab Bar and Grill.
And now they have to deal with everything going on. Anheuser-Busch pulling out, backing the St. Louis Pride, has backed them for years.
The company had faced backlash from conservatives for partnering with a transgender influencer, Dylan Mulvaney, in 2023.
So because of Anheuser-Busch pulling out, she's finding different ways to raise money for St. Louis Pride. It probably won't be as big as it was because Anheuser-Busch was a huge, huge sponsor.
The Trump administration has gone to great lengths to eliminate legal protections for LGBTQ people. During a time like this, Seduction says performing drag is more important than ever as it inspires hope in the queer community.
We have a strong foundation. I think we're, knock on wood, lucky we're in Illinois, which never really ever came out of my mouth before. But I remember seeing an article as soon as Trump announced the things that he was trying to change. Pritzker was like, I'm not adhering to any of that. I will protect the LGBTQ. I will protect minorities, you know. That was comforting to see literally days after his inauguration. I do feel sorry. I've got friends in Tennessee who can't drag and the Carolinas. The thing that most of us are doing, and when I give my speeches at my shows, I just say, you know, wherever there is drag, support it. Your attendance is needed. This is a time to let society know that we are here and we're united. It's a time to let businesses know that we are worth having at your establishment. And, you know, we always have been. But I think consistently our turnouts need to keep going up to make our presence known.
She says she and her drag family will keep showing up and showing out. I'm Aoshi Basu, IPM News.
We'll talk with a Republican congressman from Illinois. That's coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. What some are calling the big, beautiful bill that passed by the slimmest of margins in the U.S. House last week would make the 2017 federal tax cuts permanent. It would also make significant cuts to Medicaid and other safety net programs. The Congressional Budget Office says the bill would hurt lower-income earners at the expense of those who make more money. Central Illinois Republican Congressman Darren LaHood told Eric Stock he believes the bill will provide an economic boost.
Businesses, small, medium, and large, and individuals are looking for predictability and certainty in the economy, and this brings predictability and certainty in the economy. Making these tax cuts for families and working people permanent. And then the other thing is no tax on tips that helps every service worker. No tax on overtime. No tax on auto loans. I mean, these are not particularly taxes that benefit the rich in any way. I would argue they help the working poor and working families across the country. And so I feel good about the bill. I think if you look at the proposed economic growth with this bill, it'll be putting the U.S. economy at about 2.9% growth. I think it'll be higher than that. And so I proudly supported the bill.
Regarding the uncertainty in the business community, of course, there's a great deal of it now because of tariffs that have been sort of on again, off again. Is there anything to address the concerns there that business owners have raised, some of whom have had to close or try to find markets elsewhere?
Well, listen, I think when you have predictability and certainty in the economy, when you make tax cuts permanent, for instance, Eric, almost every small and medium-sized business is structured as a 199A business. We make permanent the tax rate for 199A businesses. The 100% bonus depreciation, making that retroactive for the future. That means investments that are made by, again, a business with two employees or a business with 500 employees. They now have the ability to use the tax code in a beneficial way for investments. Research and development tax code, which affects companies like Ferraro and Rivian and other Caterpillar and other industries in my district benefit from the research and development tax credit. So I look at those as are going to really help. Now, you mentioned tariffs. I've been one that has said that I don't think we should be engaging in a tariff war with our allies, particularly Canada and Mexico and our European allies. So in some ways, I disagree with the approach the president has taken. I think we should use tariffs to go after bad actors like China, but it ought to be used in a strategic and tactical way. And I think the sooner we can pause tariffs with our like-minded allies, the better.
The House bill would also raise the nation's debt limit by $4 trillion. Do you feel that's fiscally responsible, given that Republicans have consistently criticize Democratic administrations for raising the debt limit?
Well, this has been a bipartisan issue. The bottom line is we cannot default on our debts. We can't keep running up the credit card in our country. And so there would be real damage if we defaulted on our debt. And that would create an economic spiral in this country. So you know, there's blame to go around on the debt by Republicans and Democrats. I will admit that. But remember, a number of things that added to the debt, COVID added to the debt, $6 trillion we went into debt. 9/11 added $6, $7 trillion to our debt. The financial crisis of 2008 added $5, $6, $7 trillion to the debt. So, you know, that wasn't necessarily the faults of taxpayers. So, raising the debt ceiling is in many ways a necessity, but I feel better about doing that, Eric, because we also have significant spending cuts in all areas of government to help bring down our debt and turn the trajectory of the debt around. So we ought to be heading backwards from $36 trillion in debt. And the debt ceiling, obviously being raised, is not something we routinely do or should be doing, but it needed to be done here.
And you've seen the rallies, I'm sure, some outside your offices. Do you believe Republicans risk a political price for restrictions to Medicaid and other safety net programs?
Well, if you listen to what people thought was going to happen with Medicaid, that everyone was going to be cut off Medicaid and there would be real damage to the program, that didn't happen. And part of that, the reason why it didn't happen is there was a lot of pushback on it. And I was one of those. 3.3 million people in Illinois are on Medicaid. About 60% of the births in Illinois are Medicaid related. So I listened to our hospitals, particularly our rural hospitals and others that rely on Medicaid. So the drastic cuts that people thought were going to happen or people were protesting about, they're not in this bill. Now, what is in this bill as it relates to Medicaid is how do we move people that are able-bodied adults off Medicaid? So right now, Eric, we have 7 million unfilled jobs in the country, and we ought to be moving people that can work off Medicaid. And so that will save money on Medicaid. Now, whether you call that a cut to Medicaid or a transition to a job, that's clearly included here. But I think that's something we ought to be doing. I think the best social service program in the country is a job.
So you feel that the $700 billion being made up for in Medicaid is simply more people going back to work?
I think there's a significant portion of, again, able-bodied adults that we can move off Medicaid into these jobs. But what's not being cut, Eric, is women that can't afford to give birth, Medicaid is going to fund that. Developmentally disabled individuals at all levels will still have the same level of Medicaid. Seniors that need Medicaid are going to have that. So the social safety net that Medicaid provides for will still remain intact the way it is.
With Central Illinois Congressman Darren LaHood on Sound Ideas, you have said that you are considering the U.S. Senate seat that Dick Durbin is vacating next year. What factors are you looking at in deciding whether to run for that seat?
Well, it's not often, Eric, that we have open U.S. Senate seats in Illinois, and we clearly do. Those may happen once every 20 years. I love the job that I have now representing the 16th Congressional District. I enjoy my job. I enjoy serving on the Intelligence Committee and the Ways and Means Committee and the China Committee. But I've gotten encouragement to look at the U.S. Senate seat. I think there's an appetite for a Republican senator to represent the state of Illinois. So I'm going to continue to listen to my constituents, people that I have respect for, and I'll make a decision on that relatively shortly.
That's Republican Congressman Darren LaHood. He spoke with Eric Stock. The future of a state-funded program to increase diversity of faculty at colleges and universities in Illinois is in doubt as the federal administration continues to pressure higher ed to abandon DEI values. Charlie Schlinker has more.
The administration is attacking diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility policies on a variety of fronts. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul is among the collection of 15 top lawyers for states of the District of Columbia who have issued guidance on how to deal with administration demands. Above all, Raoul says, don't give in to fear of loss of funding, lawsuits, or boycotts.
But it's also important to know that if you capitulate to an unfounded criticism of your policies, this is an administration that won't stop at its first request. It will keep on coming at you because you've demonstrated vulnerability to unfounded threats.
Raoul urges schools and businesses to keep using the tools that make workplaces successful, the type of policies that prevent discrimination in the workplace or education institution in the first place, he says, are often elements of DEI policy.
So it's important to continue in the workplace, embracing employee resource groups, to review statistics to see how inclusive the environment actually is, to embrace pipeline programs for students and for employees. None of that is illegal.
The attorneys general, mainly from blue states, acknowledge the legal landscape has changed with the Supreme Court case Students for Fair Admissions, or SFFA, v. Harvard. That ruling prevents higher education from using race as a plus factor in admissions. Earlier this year, Craig Traynor, the Education Department Acting Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights, sent a Dear Colleague letter to most K-12 schools and higher education institutions, which relies heavily on the SFFA case. Traynor warns against programs that may appear on the face of them to be neutral, but are, quote, in fact motivated by racial considerations. The letter says race-based decision-making, no matter the form, remains impermissible. And, quote, a school may not use students' personal essays, writing samples, participation in extracurriculars, or other cues as a means of determining or predicting a student's race and favoring or disfavoring such students. Relying on non-racial information as a proxy for race and making decisions based on that information violates the law. That is true whether the proxies are used to grant preferences on an individual basis or a systemic one, unquote. Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell says that's overreach because the ruling is actually very narrow.
SFFA has nothing to do with K-12 schools.
Campbell says the case also doesn't address hiring and employment issues. Even in the context of college admissions, Kwame Raoul of Illinois says the ruling still allows a lot.
It does not prohibit seeking ways out to expand the pool of applications that may come into higher education institution. It does not prohibit creating a welcoming environment within institutions for diverse groups based on their background.
Raoul notes Chief Supreme Court Justice John Roberts has also pointed out applicants can talk about how race has impacted their lives, and that can be taken into consideration. California Attorney General Rob Bonta says the allegations the letter makes are not only ill-defined in a legal sense, they are sometimes internally contradictory.
It is completely irrational and mind-boggling to suggest that the things that address discrimination are somehow discrimination.
The Ed Department letter says the administration will, quote, no longer tolerate the overt and covert racial discrimination that has become widespread in this nation's educational institutions. The law is clear. Treating students differently on the basis of race to achieve nebulous goals such as diversity, racial balancing, social justice, or equity is illegal under controlling Supreme Court precedent. Bonta says he's not even sure people in the administration know what DEI really is, other than a culture wars buzzword.
Our core constitutional provisions and laws in the United States, like the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the laws that tackle age discrimination and promote pay equity, those are all what folks would call DEI.
Bonta says when such programs produce more talent and remove barriers, it's good for people and the nation. He says diversity programs are tools to make institutions successful, and the Dear Colleague letter is bluster.
This is something that I've described as a soft power that they have. The legal authority that they point to doesn't justify their position, but through intimidation, fear, scare tactics, they are bullying folks into submission, even though the action that they are asking is not required based on the authority that they're citing.
The Attorneys General Group says it is entirely appropriate to take a pause and assess programs, current case law, and the climate to make sure they're consistent, though Illinois AG Kwame Raoul says there is a fine line to walk in that assessment.
It's important to not just surrender to this notion of just being risk-averse in your balancing of what is worthy of fighting for.
There is yet another bulwark to federal threats. Here's Andrea Campbell of Massachusetts.
Rely on your state laws. They have not gone away. They are not lesser than an executive order in this context. If anything, they are lawful, and they require us to comply with them.
The group says it may be tempting for institutions to try to duck conflict in an indirect way. Kwame Raoul urges institutions to avoid scrubbing the words and trying to keep the sense of the policy.
But that's capitulating, just to say. There's nothing inherently wrong with the nomenclature of diversity, equity, inclusion, or accessibility. And we should not run from the language because we have an administration and extremists that seek to have us do so.
And Andrea Campbell of Massachusetts says if institutions do not continue to push diversity and equity, they will probably see an uptick in discrimination claims or environments that are not as inclusive as they need to be. Campbell says this moment is dark and divisive, but children are struggling. She says this is an opportunity for people and institutions to look in the mirror and ask themselves what they are going to do. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
That's all the time we have for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. And be with us again next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find our show where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.